testify of spiritual mothers and fathers in my own life, and several of them have been single women, and I'm very grateful for that. Amy Carmichael is certainly a shining example. She was the mother to literally hundreds, if not thousands, of Indian children, because, as she so beautifully states in one of her poems, "If thy dear home be fuller, Lord, for that a little emptier my house on earth, what rich reward that guerdon were." She was willing to be single, although I strongly suspect she had as many as 3 proposals of marriage. She was extremely reticent and never really told anybody that, but my research would indicate that she probably had at least that many. And she was willing to remain single, and I consider her one of my spiritual mothers, or though of course I never met her. I've met many heroines through the pages of books, and I've read all 40 of Amy Carmichael's books, most of them several times. So I'm very grateful for that. And I do want to ring the changes, if I didn't do it sufficiently in my talk on spiritual fathering and mothering, that there is no higher calling. And for the encouragement of you young women, you younger women who get very little encouragement from the world, practically no encouragement from the world, and sadly, at least in my country, very little encouragement from the church, if you do stay home and take care of your children, I just want to say that if God had given me the choice of whether I wanted to be a writer and a speaker or a mother, if I had been given that kind of option, I would certainly have said that motherhood has been the most fulfilling, if that's the word that everybody's looking for. There is no higher calling, even though the world is never going to give you any kudos for that, and you're not going to get any medals. Nevertheless, I'm convinced that to give saints to God is perhaps the greatest job that any of us can have, and that's not an original expression with me. Another spiritual mother, Janet Erskine Stewart, also a single woman, said that the job of the mother is to give saints to God. Certainly that's the job of a minister. That's the job of a spiritual father as well. What would you like me to talk about this afternoon? I'm going to talk about marriage. How about that? A title would be The Mystery of Marriage. The astounding divorce rate in our country, even among Christians, in spite of the proliferation of marriage seminars and books on marriage and programs and counselors and all the other support systems, says something about how deeply wrong people's concept of what marriage must be is. If you were to ask the average young person in America, what is marriage? I doubt that they would have an answer. And one of the things that always brings great dismay in my mind is when I get a wedding invitation from a young couple who have decided to break over all the traditional ways of sending out an invitation, and they write their own, and then I suspect that they are also going to write what they call their own vows. And in my experience, what they call vows are merely a description of how they happen to feel about each other on that particular day. It has nothing to do with a course which they choose, till death us do part. In fact, some of them go so far as to say, as long as we both shall love. And when love breaks down, and love in their terminology usually means a feeling, or as I heard Eric Alexander say at Urbana a few years ago, a glandular condition. It is not going to sustain the hard knocks that ordinary life is going to deal out to us. A mother came to me, or I guess it was in a public question and answer period, a mother said to me, "What would you tell a daughter who is planning to divorce her husband because he's not meeting all her needs?" Well, I said, in the first place, I would tell the poor girl that her expectations are outrageous. There isn't any human being that can ever meet all the needs of any other human being. As Augustine said, we are created with hunger for God. O God, thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. It is utterly unrealistic to imagine that any husband or wife can possibly meet all the needs of the spouse. And I remember hearing Jill Briscoe tell about how when her husband is out of town, she sometimes gets the phone calls from people who want to speak with Stuart. And she said, "When I hear a very distressed woman on the other end of the line and she says she doesn't want to speak to me, she has to speak to Stuart," she said, "sometimes I make a wild guess and I say, well, I have a hunch that maybe you're having marital problems." And there's a surprised pause and the person says, "Well, yes, how did you know?" And she said, "Well, I just guessed, and I bet I can guess what the problem is. You're incompatible. Is that it?" And if the person says, "Well, yes, how did you know that?" And she says, "Well, didn't you know that incompatibility is not a reason for divorce, it's a reason for marriage? There are no compatible people." She said, "I will let you in on a secret. Did you not know that Stuart and I are incompatible? And we live with two incompatible children and an incompatible dog and an incompatible cat." So I would like to suggest to you that I'll give you four things that I hope to squeeze into this time, just so you'll have some idea where I'm going. Then I will try to go there, and then I will try to remind you of where I've been. But number one, marriage is a revolution. Number two, it is a revelation. Number three, it requires respect. And number four, it is sustained by love. Those of you who may have read Mike Mason's blockbuster of a book called The Mystery of Marriage may remember that he describes marriage as being like having a tree in the living room. Mike Mason was one of Dr. Packer's students at Regent College, and Dr. Packer writes the introduction for his book and said that if Mike Mason, as a young man who had been married a total of 2 years, had come to him with suggestions, asking for Dr. Packer's suggestions as to a subject for his first book, Dr. Packer said, "I would have done my best to dissuade him from discussing the subject of marriage. But," he said, "happily for us all, Mike did not ask me. And here is his book." And I have to say, it is the best book that I've seen written in the 20th century on the subject of marriage. It's called The Mystery of Marriage. And he describes in the very beginning of the book how on his honeymoon, he and his wife visited a Trappist monastery. He had been married just a few days. He went into the little chapel alone and knelt to pray. And he said he was suddenly just overcome with the absolute conviction that he was cut out to be a monk. And the poor man was on his honeymoon. It is a revolution. If you have any understanding whatsoever of what marriage is supposed to be, you will find that it is a revolution. The fact that too many people have refused to recognize it as such has explained a good many of the divorces, I think. But it means, among other things, relinquishment, doesn't it? relinquishment of one's rights to oneself. A bride gives up her name, unless she's a feminist. She gives up her family. She gives up her home. She may give up her all the geography that's familiar to her. She gives up her independence. She gives up her right to make unilateral decisions. She gives up her privacy, however you say it here. But I have never seen a bride walking down the aisle sobbing her heart out because of all these sacrifices that she is about to make. The bride walks down the aisle with her eyes on a beloved face. And whatever price it's going to be could not possibly be too high to become one with this man. It is, again, the expulsive power of a new affection. And as I said to you earlier, I didn't consider the requirement that Jim Elliot placed on his proposal as too high a price to pay to get a man like Jim Elliot. I was willing to make a stab at learning Quechua first. But those are all things which only gradually the bride begins to come to terms with. She hasn't thought about most of them before, and if she did, they didn't look like sacrifices to her until push comes to shove and there is a decision that has to be made between the two of them after they're married, when she is sure that her husband is very badly mistaken and she has to look at that dreadful word submit. And after all, the word submit has no teeth in it whatsoever, does it, ladies? Until you think your husband's mistaken. Obviously, you don't have to submit if you both agree. It's when you disagree that the rubber meets the road. I remember coming out from my wedding with Jim and thinking of those words, till death us do part. And to me, that was just thrilling to think that we had this whole long life between us, before us, and that absolutely nothing could ever separate him and me except death. And as far as I was concerned, that was probably at least 50 years down the road. It is a revolution, and you're making what young people nowadays consider a very, very scary commitment. I've just finished reading a book on the baby boomers in the United States. Those who were born between 1946 and 1964 are classified as the baby boomers. And many things which I've been tearing my hair and wringing my handkerchief and jumping up and down and screaming about the last few years were explained there as being phenomena of the baby boomers. And one of them was that they do not make commitments. They were great at making group commitments, things like the protest against the Vietnam War, the student protests that we had during the 1960s, and that unbelievable phenomenon called Woodstock, in which there were hundreds of thousands of people congregating in somebody's cornfield. These were group commitments, but to make an individual commitment is almost a pathological impossibility. Lars and I visit many singles groups in churches, and I'm so glad to hear that Mr. Still says his church is not fragmented into special interest groups. I think it's a real, it's a bad thing. But we do visit many singles groups. They ask me to come and speak to them, and often the singles minister will tell us that his biggest problem is commitment. They are not prepared to make commitments. This is probably why they're single. They come late. We went to one conference, an all-day conference, which was supposed to start at 9 o'clock, and there were about two people there by 9:15, and they began strolling in a vague way on toward 9:30 or so. It's radical, this revolution. It goes right down to the roots of our being. It is an inescapable revolution, as poor Mike Mason found as he knelt in that little Trappist chapel. And for a Christian, it is irrevocable. We're not thinking of the escape of divorce. I heard a man use the illustration of a submarine. He had been in the submarine service, and he said one of the first things that we're taught is that if you leave the hatch open so much as a quarter of an inch, you're all going to drown. And everyone that goes into a marriage with that quarter inch of the hatch open, thinking, well, there's always an escape route, is undoubtedly going to make use of that escape route sooner or later. Marriage is also a revelation. The prize package that you thought you were getting turns out to be a surprise package, doesn't it? And no matter how you may have, no matter how well you may think that you had become acquainted with this person turns out to be full of mystery. And you hear women just in despair, rolling their eyes, shrugging their shoulders, and saying, well, isn't that just like a man? Well, what was it we wanted to marry? There really isn't anything else to marry. And if your husband acts like a man, thank God. There are far too many husbands who act like wimps. I don't know whether what that word means over here, but it's not very complimentary. Anybody who ought to be a man and is not is a wimp. So there are all kinds of surprises. I heard a story about a bride honeymooning couple, and the husband had very strictly schooled his new bride that now that they were going to this hotel for their wedding night, he said, I don't want you to say or do anything which will reveal the fact that we are newly married. And so she said she would certainly do her best, and everything went fine until the next morning. They were in the restaurant for breakfast, and she gave the waiter her order, and the husband said, is that all you eat for breakfast? Other people might have drawn all kinds of conclusions from that one. Lars and I have a very dear friend who's 78 years old. His wife died last March, and he remarried in October. And we had a very beautiful letter from him describing the tremendous adjustments. He had been married, I think, over 50 years, and his wife was also a widow. She had only been widowed a year before. And he said, I'm discovering that there are two ways of doing things, two ways of arranging the day's schedule. He said, I go to bed early, and my wife goes to bed late. I get up early, she gets up late. Of course, there's the old problem of the toothpaste tube. He didn't mention that, but are you a roller or a squeezer or a twister? And that can cause some serious marital problems. He said, we have had a discussion about when a towel is dirty. Discussions about how to do the washing up. So these are revelations, aren't they? And I suppose for me, the most unsettling revelation in having had the experience of living with three very different men, all of them Christians, all of them with one or two things in common, principally the fact that they liked me, but there wasn't much else in which they were similar. It's always a revelation to me to know what a terrible sinner I am. If you want to do the arithmetic, you can easily figure out that I've been single much more than I've been married. I had 2 years and 3 months with Jim. I had 4 years and 8 months with Ad. Lars and I have been married a little over 12 years now, so he heaved a great sigh of relief after we passed 8 years, since number two had doubled the amount of time that I lived with number one. But you can figure it up. I'm 63 years old, so I've been single most of my life. And so I have actually had the experience of going to church and in the part of the service where we confess our sins, I have had to scratch my head to think of any, because I was living by myself a good part of the time. Very often would go days without having another person to speak to, and this was certainly true in the jungle. But when I am married, I can assure you, I do not have any trouble thinking of all the things I have done that I ought not to have done, and all the things that I have left undone that I ought to have done, and there is no health in me. It is a revelation of myself, not only a revelation of what this man contains, but a revelation of who I stand, or how I stand before God. In my little book, Let Me Be a Woman, in which I gave my daughter some advice on what it means to be a woman, and it's not a book only for the married, it was written primarily as a feeble protest against the feminist position that we were hearing so constantly, but I also did give her some hints on marriage, since the book was to be my wedding present for her. And I reminded her that you marry a man, not a woman. And men are different from women. As old Gert Behana used to say, she was an old lady who was just a delightful speaker in our country. She said, men are men, they are not women. And she herself had gone through three by divorce before she became a Christian. And that would certainly seem terribly self-evident and axiomatic, and yet we need to be reminded. This man is going to do incomprehensible things, and you men are saying exactly the same thing. Who can ever understand these women? And I'm told that when Freud was nearing the end of his life, having spent his whole life studying personality and character and psychology, he threw up his hands and he said, what do women want? What do they want? And he did not know the answer, and I don't think there's any woman in the world that could have told him the answer. And so you men, if you find women mysterious and incomprehensible, you're not alone in that. But there is a mystery here, which I'm going to get to in a little bit later. And another thing that I reminded my daughter is you not only marry a man who is unpredictable and unruly and unmanageable, he's going to turn out to be a whole lot bigger and a whole lot louder and a whole lot tougher and a whole lot hungrier and a whole lot dirtier than you are expecting, but you also marry a husband. And a husband is not interchangeable with a wife. It is not a 50-50 proposition. The idea that marriage is supposed to be a 50-50 proposition is also one of the reasons for divorce. I am responsible 100% for my obedience to God, and my obedience to God cannot be contingent on that of my husband. I hear women say, well, I can't submit to my husband because he does not love me as Christ loved the church. Now may I see the hands of you men who believe that you have in fact loved your wives as Christ loved the church in every particular. You see, there is no such thing because we're sinners. You know what your responsibility is before God. It's spelled out very clearly for you in the scriptures. We know what the standard is, and we see this huge gap between God's standard and our performance. And I say to those same women, and have you submitted to your husband as the church is to submit to Christ? Well, but he doesn't love me as Christ loved the church. And I'm not supposed to submit to him until he does that. And then if the husband says, well, I cannot love her as Christ loved the church because she doesn't submit to me as the church submits to Christ, what do we have? A permanent standoff. There will never be any harmony between those two because each is making his obedience dependent upon the perfect obedience of the other, which is an impossibility. You marry a husband who stands before God with an office. He holds an office, not that he has achieved, not that he has earned, not that his wife delegates to him. It is an office assigned by God. And as I said earlier this morning, the young man who divorces his wife because he doesn't want to be a father and he doesn't want to be a husband is forgetting that he already is a father and a husband, and he does not have a choice. I've heard men say, but my wife is more spiritual than I am. My wife is really better at that. She has more leadership qualities. I'd much rather let her be the head of the house. It's not an option. It is God's command and God's divine assignment for our freedom and our peace and our harmony. And I see marriages which are in an awful mess because one or the other or both have not recognized the divine assignment. It has nothing to do with competence. And I think this is one area of huge confusion. When I say to people, I submit to my husband Lars, not because I am a shrinking violet type who cannot make up her own mind, has no opinions of her own, and needs to be told what to do, isn't that nonsense? Do I submit to him because I happen to be born with a submissive temperament? May I ask to see the hands of you women who were born with a gentle and quiet spirit? A thing very precious in the sight of God. It does not come naturally. And so you men, what are you stuck with? A sinner, a rebel, an unsubmissive woman. And if a sinful man and a sinful woman are going to live together 365 days a year, it is going to take an awful lot of the grace of God. And I do not stand before you as Exhibit A of all these things that I'm talking about. I can only give you what this book says, and just remember, if you have any arguments, you're not arguing with Elizabeth Elliot, except where you think I have departed from the scriptures, but you're arguing with God. I do not submit to my husband Lars because he is taller than I am, better looking than I am, smarter than I am, more spiritual than I am. He may be all of the above. That has nothing to do with God's command. It says that wives are to submit to their husbands as to the Lord. Now, what does that mean? It means that my husband has to submit to the Lord in accepting that divine assignment to be the head. And my submission to God is going to be signaled by my submission to my husband. You marry a man, you marry a husband, and you marry a sinner. There isn't anything else to marry. And that goes for all of us, doesn't it? When I remind myself that I am expecting too much of my husband, and after all, I did marry a sinner, I need also to remind myself that poor Lars is also stuck with a sinner. And I am anything but a paragon of virtue. This husband holds an office which I am commanded to respect. And both of us are going to need a lot of grace. I heard Ruth Graham say that if a husband and wife would get together every day and pray in the morning, each for the other, each for the work that the other had to do that day, she doubted that there would ever be a divorce in that kind of a family. And I have made a rule for myself, which I confess gets broken far too often, But it's a simple way of looking at my job as a wife. It is my job to make Lars's job as easy and pleasant as I possibly can. And when I have complaints about my husband, which I am tempted to present to God, let me remember that very possibly the reason that I have this complaint is because I have not made it as easy and pleasant for him to do what he's supposed to do. Am I making it easy and pleasant for him to be my head, for example? I'm sure that I have rarely made it as easy and pleasant as I'm supposed to. There are a lot of things that have to be worked out, depending on personality and temperament and background and the work that each has to do. Often people go to Lars at the book table and in a rather hesitant way say, "Can I ask you a personal question?" And he almost always knows what's coming. "How do you feel about having your wife standing up in the front and you're always at the back at the book table? What do you do with your self-image?" This is the great question that Americans are so concerned about, the self-image. Well, Lars answers facetiously to that when he says, "Don't worry about my self-image, I don't have one." But he has a more serious answer, which is that God has not called him to do what I do, and he has not called me to do what he does. I couldn't sell a book if my life depended on it. And he travels with me, and he takes care of me, and he protects me, and he does all the things that a husband is supposed to do. In fact, he pursued me for 4 years before I finally was persuaded to marry him. And one of the things that moved me over the line, I had blinders on. I could not imagine that God could possibly want me to have a third husband. I thought it was a miracle he gave me the first one. But when Lars said to me, "I want to take care of you, I want to be the one building the fences around you, and I am going to stand on all sides," that just about did me in. Took him a few more weeks to persuade me, but anyway, that's what he does. He builds the fences around me. A husband is meant to be a protector and a provider, because don't forget that God made Eve for Adam. The woman was made for the man, not the man for the woman. If you miss it in Genesis 2, you can pick it up in 1 Corinthians 11. God brought Eve to Adam. He didn't bring Adam to Eve. He made Eve from the man, for the man, from the man, brought her to the man, and she was named by the man. That gives me a clue as to what my position is before God, not only physically, but theologically and ontologically. And this is the deep concern that I have about the confusion over women's roles. It goes way back to Genesis, but it is brought to its climax in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, where he speaks of this mystery. And that brings me to my third point. We've been talking about revolution and revelation. The third thing is that I am to respect the assignment that God has given to my husband. Just as a soldier respects the officer, not because the officer is necessarily a better man, but because he holds an office and he bears authority which has been conferred upon him. And my husband bears authority. And when I have a critical spirit, when I belittle him in front of other people, which I have certainly done, those are ways in which I am violating the image of God in him. Each of us, everyone in this room, who is married to someone made in the image of God. And it takes both male and female, doesn't it, to represent under two separate modalities that divine image. I don't understand it, I simply believe it. It is a mystery. And the mystery of marriage is the central mystery of human life, because it represents the deepest mystery that we know anything about, which is the relationship between Christ and the church. And I once heard a woman in what is called the Evangelical Women's Caucus, a very vocal feminist movement in the evangelical church in the States, I once heard her speak about what she called egalitarian marriage. And she described her marriage as being 50-50. She brought home half the money, washed half the dishes. He brought home half the money, took care of the kids. And it worked just wonderfully. They had arranged things according to their tastes and preferences. And everything was working very beautifully. The text that she used to prove this was Ephesians 5:21, be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. She erased the rest of the chapter, husbands love your wives, wives submit to your husbands, and chapter 6, children obey your parents. All of that is immaterial now because we are all equally subservient to each other. And so when there was a question period, you can be sure I had a question. I said, I said, do you see any difference at all between the way a husband is to submit to his wife and the way a wife is to submit to her husband? And she said, no. And I said, well, may I then take this passage and reverse the nouns? And she said, yes. So I read, wives, love your husbands as the church loved Christ. Husbands, be subject to your wives, for the woman is the head of the man, as the church is the head of Christ. And she stopped me. Oh, well, she said, you can't carry the analogy that far. Well, whose analogy was it, and what does an analogy mean? But when I hear discussions, endless, endless discussions, about the roles of wives and husbands, the roles of women in the church, the question that I want with all my heart to raise is, but what about the mystery? And their eyes glaze and their jaws drop and they say, mystery? Yes, the mystery of Christ and the church. This is the crucial question. I can no more reverse those roles in the church than I can reverse them in my marriage. What obtains in the most intimate relationship between a husband and wife obtains also in the church. Authority is vested in men. The buck stopped with Adam. Eve was the one who suggested that they sin. She became the initiator. Adam, where he should have dug in his heels and said, absolutely no, I'm going to protect you from this, gave in, capitulated, became the responder. And so the roles were reversed. We've been in a horrible mess ever since. And it's gotten a whole lot worse in the last few decades. We are not interchangeable. We are not reversible because of the mystery of Christ in the church. I see the Christian home as a sort of a theater in which a drama is being enacted, a mystery play, if you will. And the parts have already been assigned, the characters. Same thing goes for the church. Well, I could go on and on that subject. I will not. The last thing I want to talk about is love, and I am not talking about a mood or a feeling or a temperament or a glandular condition. I'm talking about 1 Corinthians 13. For a man to love his wife is to cherish and protect and sacrifice himself for her. Love means sacrifice, doesn't it? As we said in the discussion on parenthood. A man is to lay down his life for his wife. What does that mean? Christ laid down his life for us. And in the same way, he says, you husbands are to lay down your lives for your wives. Lost my place here. Ephesians 5. Love your wives as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for it. And remember that when Jesus took the lowest place of a slave in an Eastern household and washed feet, he was not abdicating his position. He said, you call me Lord and Master. And you say, well, for so I am. And if I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, then you must wash one another's feet. In the same way, men are bound to love their wives as they love their own bodies. And in verse 33, each of you must love his wife as his very self. That takes sacrifice. And for a woman, submission generally means, judging by the lack of a show of hands here as to how many of us were born submissive, it means that the cross is going to cut right across our human nature. And everything in me rises up in rebellion against the word submission. But I know that it is the woman's true liberation. True femininity means submission. And you men have your part in that because you are members of the bride of Christ. And we all submit to him as members of the church. 1 Corinthians 13 is a description of love which has nothing to do with feelings. Love is patient. Love is kind. Envies no one. Never boastful. Never conceited. Never rude. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands of how many of you gentlemen help your wife in with her chair at the table at home when there are no guests. I spoke to a seminary class one time and I asked this question, and the men, there was not one hand. And so then I gave them 2.5 hours of lecture, which was happened to be the subject of that day, courtesy. And I said, now I want you to go home and write a paper on this and bring back your thoughts on how courtesy represents Christian living. And so they came back the next week. They'd had plenty of time to think and do research on this. And I said, is there any man in this room now who has altered his behavior toward his wife in the tiniest particular because of this study? There was not one hand. Well, that was certainly marvelous for my self-esteem as a communicator and adjunct professor at that point. Love is never rude. Never selfish, not quick to take offense. One time I was very upset with my husband, Lars, and I thought that he owed me an apology. And we were lying in bed, you know, I as far as I could get on this side, he as far as he could get over this side. I did not want to be touched by the tip of a finger. I was so angry. I was lying there with the tears running into my ears and saying to myself, he knows he hurt me. He must apologize. You're not supposed to let the sun go down on your wrath. And guess what? And I didn't know whether to jab him in the ribs and wake him up and say, you owe me an apology or what. But instead of that, I prayed, I got out of bed, I read this passage and put Elizabeth in place of the word love. Elizabeth is never rude, never selfish, never quick to take offense. Elizabeth keeps no score of wrongs. I've been making a long list. Love is not a feeling. As Christ loved the church means sacrifice. It means self-giving on the part of all of us. Marriage is a mystery. It will cause a revolution. It will present you day after day with a revelation. It requires respect, and it is sustained by love. God bless you. If the men refuse to be masculine in politics, the church, and the family, should the women take over? Okay, Lars is here to remind me of things that I need to say that I forget about sometimes. In a question and answer period, necessarily I have to give a brief answer. Sometimes that makes the questioner feel that I have given them the brush off. I don't mean ever to do that. I will try always to give a biblical answer, if I can. If I can't give a biblical answer, I may give an opinion, and I hope you will certainly know the difference. You're perfectly free to discard opinions. I would hope you'd be a little slower to discard what the Scripture says. But I will attempt to give a brief answer. This is exactly what I have seen happening in my country over the past several decades. I don't believe we would have a feminist movement if men had not refused to accept their masculine responsibility. I think that the women's issues are most emphatically men's issues, and it was because of failure on the part of men that we are in the mess that we're in. But two wrongs do not make a right, and women often raise this question. It is not a new question at all. What if my husband is refusing to take the spiritual headship in the home? What am I supposed to do? Now, that is a very difficult question, because if you have children, somebody has to take spiritual responsibility for those children. And I don't think that it's the wisest course for a woman to try to bamboozle her husband into having family devotions or doing anything specific about the spiritual training of the children. If he is not doing it, then he has to answer to God for not taking the position of the priest in the home, which he is by God's assignment. I would strongly urge the woman to teach the children on her own, but to do it in a tactful way so that it's not obtruding on her husband's time or convenience or anything else. There's no use making him angry by teaching the children. That is a relatively simple question, I think. We have the example of Timothy, who we don't know anything about his father and his grandfather, but we certainly know that he was trained by his mother and his grandmother. So there's a scriptural precedent there. When the women are aware of the fact that there are many things that need to be done in the church that the men are supposed to do and they're not doing, I think it's time, and here I can only give you my opinion because these are not covered in detail in Scripture, but I do think it's that the women quit. I don't know anything about his father and his grandfather, but we certainly know that he was trained by his mother and his grandmother. So there's a scriptural precedent there. When the women are aware of the fact that there are many things that need to be done in the church that the men are supposed to do and they're not doing, I think it's time, and here I can only give you my opinion because these are not covered in detail in Scripture, but I do think it's time that the women quit doing men's jobs. And of course they come back and say, but then it will not get done. And I say, how do you know? Men are always tempted, as Adam was ever since the Garden of Eden, men are tempted to be laid back, as we say, and let the women have their way. It'll keep us out of arguments, and just let them do whatever they want to do. And so if the women want to run the church, the women generally succeed in running the church, and the men gradually fall away so that there are fewer and fewer men. And I hate to think of the ordination of women becoming a woman's job. I think that that's the direction in which it's likely to go. We're getting far more women now in the seminaries. Not that it's that they've outnumbered men, but I see the number increasing every year of women going to seminaries, and gradually it's going to be a matter of attrition, and the men will be falling down on their job there. It would seem to me that we women are not answerable to God for not doing the job that the men didn't do. The men are the ones that will be answerable to God. And if the job does not get done in the church, it's possible that God, by His Holy Spirit, would get through to some of these men because the women are not doing it. That's all I'm going to say on that. There's a hand back there, a courageous man.
Can I say both I've exposure. I'm wondering, in the light of the principles you established for us, with which I basically agree, would you care to comment on the effects on our missionary strategy?
Missionary strategy. Thank you for that. I've had a little experience in that myself, and I'm very grateful for the chance to say something about it. I was in linguistic work, which of course was just an ancillary kind of work where I was not establishing a church, and it was long before a church was established among the Colorados. When I went to work with Jim after we were married among the Quechuas, there had been no believers in that area until Jim and Pete Fleming worked there as two single men, and they had 50 baptized believers by the end of that first year. So we had, or by the end of the second year, Jim was killed after 2 years and 3 months. By the end of the second year, we had about 50 baptized believers. And when Jim was planning to go into the Alcas, of course, he and I sat down and discussed in detail what I was to do if he got killed. We knew very well that these people had killed everybody that had ever gone in there. Nobody had ever come back alive from oil hunters and rubber hunters and gold hunters. And so Jim said, without any hesitation, even though Jim was Plymouth Brethren, and you know how the Plymouth Brethren feel about women opening their mouths at all, Jim said, you will have to teach the believers. And the reason he said that was because there were no scriptures. There was literally no one who could have done the job. So Jim didn't come back. And the Indians immediately assumed that I would take over the responsibility of the church. But the very next Saturday, it was Thursday that we learned that the men were dead. 2 days later, I was back in my station, and I called three men, young men, that Jim had picked out as being potential leaders. And I asked them to come to my house, and I sat them down and I said, here's a church, and you are responsible. Jim will not be back, and I'm not supposed to do Jim's job. Now I said, I will be here, I would be very happy to do whatever I can do to help and support you as you take over this awesome responsibility. And because you have no scriptures, I'm here to help you with translating whatever passages you want to use. And two of these three men did read some Spanish, very haltingly, but not, but they could manage. So from that time on, one of those three men would come every Saturday. We would talk about whatever he wanted to preach on the next day. We would translate what needed to be translated, the scriptures, and I would try to elicit from him illustrations from his jungle life and whatnot. And those men would get up and preach. Now, they did it very haltingly, of course, and I could have preached a far better sermon than any of them. But that church would not exist today if I had done that. Competence is not a warrant for a woman to take over a man's position. And those men grew by leaps and bounds, and I was not the only helper that they had. They began to help each other. And of course, Jim and I had translated the book of Luke. So although this question often comes up, I do think that wherever it is possible, as it was in my case, that a woman ought not to do the job. Many places women have gone and they've been the only person to begin the work and start the church and teach the believers. And it's sad that is the case, that the men have not been there. When I went to Ecuador, there were 79 single women missionaries. There were two single men. And I don't know what the statistics are today of men versus women, but it seems to have been the history of missions. But wherever it's possible, a woman needs to take a back seat and see to it that the men have the opportunity to do what God calls them to do. How would you counsel a woman for whom submission to her husband goes contrary to God's will? For example, not letting her go to church. I know every time I open my mouth on this subject that I'm going to get that question. And I know cases where exactly this. I know several cases where this was exactly the case. And I began to see that there was a very subtle way in which the wife was getting out of order. She begins to use her spirituality as a weapon against the husband. The husband feels threatened by this, and the husband in both cases, or at least several of the cases that I know, said to his wife, "You love God more than you love me," which of course was perfectly true. "And I'm sick and tired of hearing about that church and you being away and having to go to church on Sunday morning and Sunday night and Wednesday night. And, you know, I've just had it up to here." And I know one of the cases ended in divorce because the woman said that she could not do the will of God and be married to that man. I would refer that person to 1 Peter 3 because Peter speaks clearly to the question of a woman having to submit to a man who is being disobedient or if he is a non-Christian. And the Greek words there will allow either possibility. If a man either is not a Christian or is not acting like a Christian, this is a very common situation. And it's Peter speaking through the Holy Spirit that a woman is to submit, and she is given the very powerful weapon of prayer and of a gentle and quiet spirit. And she is not to panic. She is to take Sarah as her example. Abraham asked her to do some wrong things, and she did not give way to hysterical fears, but called him Lord and submitted to him, and God took care of Sarah in that case. So my first question to when this comes up is this a real case or is this a hypothetical case? And of course, I don't know in this case, perhaps it is a real case that you know of in your church. The only cases that I've heard of where it is clearly God's word against the husband's word are cases where, for example, a husband says to his wife, "I'd like you to sleep with the boss so that I will get a raise or a promotion," or something like that. And you better be careful. All I can say to these women is you better be very careful that you have a "thus saith the Lord." Now, the Lord does say that we are not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together. He does not say you must go to prayer meeting, you must go to Sunday school, you must go to Sunday morning church, you must go to this, you must go to that. So you must be very careful that you have the word of the Lord against your husbands. But again, I am not the one to spell out the exceptions. I'm simply here to say this is what God's word says. This is what I'm here to proclaim. The only other question we have here. Okay, well, you pull the blind. In a previous conference here, a speaker suggested that your book, No Graven Image, reflected the fact that when you lost Jim Elliot, you repressed your grief. Do you think that his analysis has any basis? I take it that this speaker felt there was a lot of negative feeling in the book which had this background. That's a new question to me. Many people misunderstood my novel. It is a novel about the sovereignty of God. If you read it, I would strongly recommend that you try to get your hands on the copy that has Dr. Packer's introduction. Dr. Packer read me loud and clear, and the first time I met him, he introduced himself to me as a fan of mine because he had read my novel, No Graven Image. It had absolutely nothing to do with Jim's death, and it is not an autobiographical story. I guess, as Graham Greene said, every novelist gets accused of doing everything that any character he ever created did. So Graham Greene was accused of murdering his best friend and I don't know what all. So people read that book as though it were my story. Nothing in the book happened to me. It is the story of a young missionary woman in Ecuador, but it is not my story. However, every book comes out of who the author is. And the things that happened to my heroine taught her the same lessons that the things which have happened to me have taught me. And I've already told you about three things, two in addition to Jim's death. one being the loss of my informant and the loss of all my language work. So the book is a story of a woman who has some things happen which are totally shocking and unexpected. And she has to come to terms with the fact that God does not and need not explain himself. He simply says, trust me. Such a thundering silence. There's a hand way back there. Yes, sir.
Can I ask Steve today if you could offer an opinion? I mean, you are obviously very well placed, given your experience of the American evangelical scene over a good number of years, to see the trends taking place. Now, we're all alarmed over here by the war statistics and that kind of thing among Christians, and of course, it's now spilling over here. But I wonder how you see the next generation, whether you have hope of a recovery of a biblical lifestyle amongst evangelicals, or whether you throw up your hands.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I certainly don't throw up my hands. I do believe that God is the God of the resurrection, and he can bring new life. I see, I meet a lot of young people who are determined that when they get married, it is going to be for life, and they only want to do it once. And I think they too are alarmed. And so many of the Christian young people that we meet come from broken homes, and they've seen the devastation. They've experienced the devastation in their own lives, and that in itself has made them determined that they will not go that way. Also, my book, Passion and Purity, which is about sexual purity and tells the love story of Jim Elliot and me in those 5.5 years of waiting for each other, has had a tremendous popularity in the States. I've been just overwhelmed with the response to that, and it is very no-nonsense, scriptural kind of thing about staying out of bed. And that's very heartening to me, that there are hundreds of Christian young people who are determined to preserve that gift of virginity. I do believe that God is at work. I am not in a position to say how or where. Obviously, the churches who invite me are churches who have a pretty good idea what I'm likely to say, and they would not be inviting me if they didn't want to hear that. So I'm not in touch with the broad picture of the church in the United States. I just get rumors of some of the terrible things that are going on, and can only trust that the Lord has his servants here and there who are going to encourage them. I think just the AIDS itself has alerted a lot of people, Christian and non-Christian. A woman I know said that she doesn't believe AIDS is a judgment of God. She believes it is the mercy of God to keep people out of hell. That's an interesting way of looking at it.
Elizabeth, could we go back to this? Don't go ahead.
Speak at the
moment. No. As long as you hear, you can. Not biologically so much, but temperamentally as to personality and so on. Masculinity and femininity can be very relative. There are very masculine women and very, very often very submissive, perhaps almost effeminate men are drawn to them, and well, we have a Margaret Thatcher, you know. tell us a little. What do you think about that? I don't mean politically.
It's a sexist question, Mr. Still. What do we mean when we say a man has feminine characteristics? It's narrowing down feminine characteristics more than they should be. We know that Jesus was tender and loving and compassionate, and he overturned the tables of the money changers. I don't think he was being feminine in one way and masculine in another. He was being a man. He was being fully a man. He was being only a man. And he was being God's man. And that's what I would say. Every man has what have been classified as feminine characteristics. And in some, they may be more obvious than what is classified as masculine. But I think the mistake is simply in defining them that way.
Now, discuss the other sex.
Discuss the other sex. I would say the same thing. I am a hard-driving, argumentative woman capable of making it on my own. I've done a lot of things that a lot of men have not done, and I don't think that makes me masculine at all. It's simply that we're given different gifts, aren't we? And to say that these are masculine characteristics is to narrow down what masculinity is and to narrow down what femininity is. Both of us have certain qualifications which overlap, and they are supposed to. A man should be tender as well as strong. A woman should be strong as well as tender. Any doctor can tell you that women are not the weaker sex in some respects. We do not have the upper body strength of you men, but the fact that a woman can bear pain much more than a man can would indicate that we have a certain kind of strength. And so the different ways in which our masculinity and femininity are signaled are according to God's gifts. I think of the great differences in my three husbands. One of the ways in which God persuaded me that he really was trying to get my attention through this man, Lars, and that he did want me to stop and consider whether or not I would consider a third marriage, was when I came across the verse in 1 Corinthians 12, men have different gifts, but it is the same Lord that accomplishes his purposes through them all. I am very much aware that because I am by nature argumentative and highly opinionated and willful and all of these other odious things, I probably have to pray more than a lot of women that God will allow me to be truly a woman and only a woman and a feminine woman. I don't want to be anything else, but it doesn't come naturally, and we all struggle with different sins and limitations, don't we?
While somebody's thinking of another question, did you tell them?
No.
When Elizabeth's second husband, Addison Leach, was dying, he was at home at the time, and she needed some help to take care of him. And so she had called Gordon Conwell Seminary and tried to get a student. She found one, and he was to move in on a Monday, and that was the very day that Ad Leach died. So during the evening, she was thinking about this and decided to go ahead and have lodgers. And so the first man moved in, and then she also got a second seminary student to live there. So she had two lodgers, or renters, or whatever you call them, to live there in the house for 2 years. The end, of course, was that the first lodger married her daughter, and the second lodger, yeah, married her, which is me. I married her. And it's a strange way to meet your wife or your husband. But one of the things that I noticed after moving in there, it didn't take me very long, just a few months, was to realize that here was a woman who was very capable of taking care of herself and had been on her own for a long time. But I also realized that here was a woman who appreciated a man and would rather be taken care of than to be taken care of by herself. And I have to say that even though when she stands at the microphone or some of the work that she does, you may wonder about this, there's never any thoughts in my mind as to who is the head of the family. And although we haven't, I say we haven't ever come to any kind of a situation where I've had to say, okay, this is what we're going to do. I did one time, I was having to decide something, and I came up to her one time, and I told her, I said, I wanted her opinion about this because I had to make a decision, and I said, you go ahead and tell me what exactly what you think about this, and then I'll probably go ahead and do what I want to do anyway. So, but we haven't had that kind of a problem. But I know that she does look to me, if this should happen, then I am the one to make the decision. Of course, I can always refer to a book, Let Me Be a Woman, and say, here's what you wrote on page 63, and you have to live to it. You may think that's my advantage. I don't think I'll ever have to do that. She does live out what she stands up and speaks about. And my, you know, people worry about my self-image. It has never bothered me to be at the back or to do the books or whatever I do. I think God has given us different gifts, and her experiences are certainly different. I could remember, I could use her illustrations and give a talk or something. It wouldn't be mine. But what we do complementary. Is that right? Somehow or another, you know what I mean. And it does work very well. And believe me, we do go by Gren at home. We're not, this Elliot bit is on the road, and it's for your convenience. And as she said, if I get called Mr. Elliot, I either just answer or I tell him I'm the third one or whatever. I had a dream not long ago with Ad Leach came in the dream, and we were checking into a hotel. He was standing there while I was checking in, and the end of it was he looked at me and winked, and he said, how's it going, son? Do you have any other questions? No? We're going to be out of here early today. Yes, sir.
Could you have said something more about the absence of heroes for young people today? I inherited two books by a Christian writer, Arthur Mead, a previous generation, 1,000 Heroes. And I've had some very inspiring children's addresses and sermon illustrations from those hero figures described in those books. And as you say, there's been a drying up of this for young people growing up today. Could you comment further?
Thank you. I talked just yesterday at lunch in Aberdeen about this, as I think I mentioned, and one or two of the young people there said, we've been so horribly disappointed in people that we have made heroes out of that we're just reluctant to ever look up to anyone again because we're going to find out that they have clay feet. And I certainly understand that, and it has been extremely disillusioning for young people in our country when their last heroes were athletes, and then the athletes turn out to be on drugs or something like that. It does pull the rug out from under it. I was interested that in the New English Bible, the word heroes is used a number of times. David had heroes, and they're listed there. It's so important, and the reason I brought the subject up this morning, of course, was that we are scrutinized, and we are leaders, and we need to be extremely cautious and on our faces before God to keep us pure and obedient so that we will not let down these people. But I don't hesitate to present heroes to young people and say, this is an example to be followed. I think the enormous popularity of the film Chariots of Fire just illustrated the hunger that people have for a hero. And here was a man who, for what appeared to be a religious scruple of just a very trivial nature, was willing to put a gold medal, an Olympic gold medal, on the line. And people are just floored by that kind of commitment. And I find the same reaction when I tell the story of Jim Elliot. Jim Elliot's journals have been published in full, so if anybody thinks that he was a plaster saint, they need to read the journals. He is very much a fallible man, and he makes it very plain in there that he had all sorts of faults and weaknesses and felt very discouraged and everything else. But the commitment that those five men had was astonishing to the world when the story broke, because for one thing, I don't think people realized that there were still Stone Age people in the world. At that time, they hadn't discovered that tribe in the Philippines that was made so much of. And for another thing, there isn't anything that people are willing to die for. And I often say to young people, what do you live for? Is it worth dying for? Well, if it's not worth dying for, it's not worth living for. And they just look at me as if, well, where'd you ever get that idea? But when I ask, what do you live for? Most of them have no answer. So it's wonderful to see somebody that has a reason for living. And Eric Liddell was challenged, of course, by the Prince of Wales and by the President of the Olympics, who were furious with him for putting the honor of the British Empire on the line because of this silly religious scruple. And they accused him of arrogance. And he turned in the most gracious way. Some of you would perhaps remember this moment in the film. And he said, no. He said, it is the man who would seek to dissuade another man to act to... It is the man who would seek to persuade another to act against his conscience who is arrogant.
How are you trying to get Charles so to find heroes? How do you do that?
How am I trying to
say Charles again, that how are you pointing them to him? How do you help them practice that? If they don't have it, what do you do?
Lars is reminding me of my niece and nephew. I have a 20-year-old nephew and a 22-year-old niece. And Lars says, how am I seeking to point them to heroes? We talk about these things a lot. I don't know that I've ever done anything specific about Charles and Gallaudet. Can you think of some? Did you have something special in mind?
Well, I know. I think you've just mentioned books, but I didn't know, you know, the fact of telling people that this is what they need and the whole community.
Yes, it was these two that were at the table when I talked with the young people in the States a year or so ago, asking them for heroes. And as for my responsibility to my grandchildren, I feel very responsible for them. I think the gift of being a grandmother is a tremendous one, and I have six grandchildren, and I try to feed them books all the time, which will give them heroes. Just recently I ordered from Moody Press a whole stack of books about some of the great missionary heroes. They were my heroes, and I want them to be my grandchildren's heroes too. Not that they need to know that this person was perfect. And when I wrote the biography of Amy Carmichael, it was with the great hope and the prayer that I would be able to introduce this great woman whose life has profoundly influenced my own to a generation that has never heard of her. Is there another question? Sir, at the back.
It's actually two questions. The first is, I'd like to ask the women here, how would you have reacted had a man been speaking this afternoon about husband and wife relationships? I ask that just when I preach myself, I'm have to like abuses by the prostitutes of the from a lot of the women, especially the younger ones, there's been quite a resentment against what I've said from God's word.
Of course.
I wonder if it's tied up with meeting a man singer. And the other question was how do we get men to react to those same passages? Women react very openly, either for or against what's said in those passages, but men just seem to be totally, they can't move by what God is saying in those words.
Well, thank you. It doesn't surprise me at all that you get opposition from the women, and so do I. I think they have to take it from me a little bit better than they would take it from a man, but the whole point is what you are saying and what I am saying is what God says. It is not Elizabeth Elliot's opinion. Anybody ought to know that I would have better sense than to stick my neck out and say these things if I didn't have the Word of God. And if it was a matter of my temperament, I would never have come up with that kind of conclusion, of course. So you have to continue to be faithful and pay the price. Why do men not react in this way? I think I'm reminded of another time when I had a question and answer session in a church, and somebody asked from the floor, why is it that the women are more ready to take spiritual responsibility in the church and in the home than the men? I think it was a woman who asked the question. And the minister who was sitting behind me jumped up and he said, I would like to answer that question in one word, disobedience. And I was glad that he said that, because the men would have to take it better from him than they would have from me. But I don't know what else to say. Why are men not more eager to find what God says about their responsibility as husbands and fathers? One of the problems that is raised when there are discussions about marriage is that a man does not want to acknowledge that there is a problem, because when he does so, he is then admitting that he is not in control. And perhaps this works just as much in the church as it does in the home. I've done quite a bit of reading, and as I say, I do some listening to television programs and whatnot. And the number one problem in marriage, way ahead of everything else, is communication. And it is never the men complaining that the women will not communicate. It is the women complaining that the men don't communicate. The men don't want to communicate because they're likely to find out that there's a problem. They don't want to hear about it. They are in control. So, I don't know. Maybe you can give me an answer later to that one. I think I saw another hand over
right
here
off to your right.
Somewhere.
Right.
Okay,
Mrs. Elliott, most of us here would agree with you that we don't believe that women should be preaching. Can you help us in distinguishing between what you've been doing and what we seek to do? And leading on from that, I think so often the feminist arguments are against the traditional stereotype of women's guild making tea. Can you speak more positively about encouraging women's ministry within the church, perhaps particularly single women?
Thank you. I've already forgotten the first part.
It was really about distinguishing between...
Oh, distinguishing between what I'm doing. Thank you. A very valid question, and I may be wrong. I may be completely out of order in what I'm doing. It has been very difficult to sort all these things out, and when I began doing what I'm doing, the feminist issue had not arisen. For very good reasons, I get challenged about this, and I have made a few rules for myself, which anybody can argue with because I can't find them in the scripture, but ways in which, within the terms of my own culture, I am attempting to signal the position that I've been given as I see it. First thing I would say is that we really don't know, I don't think anybody knows exactly what Paul meant when he said that women are to keep silence in the church. It was also Paul who said that women were permitted to pray and prophesy. I think of prophecy, as I understand Paul's use of the word prophecy, it wasn't foretelling the future, but rather building up and encouraging the church. And that is what I intend to do. I don't think of myself as a preacher ever. When people say, well, that was a good sermon, I correct them and I say it was just a talk. But I will never speak in a Sunday morning church service, not because the Bible makes a distinction between Sunday morning and Sunday evening or any other service, but because I see that as the apex of the corporate life of the church. It is there that the word is proclaimed and the sacraments are administered. I do not want to be in that position. I will speak in other meetings in the church, which are mixed, provided a man is in charge. I would not have spoken to this group if a woman had been in charge of the group. So, as I said in my introduction, I intend to be, I believe that I am, under the authority of the Word, under the authority of Christ, of this church, if this were a church, and under the authority of the man who is in charge of the meeting, as well as under the authority of my husband. Paul said that women were to keep silence in the church. He said they could also pray and prophesy. So somewhere in between there, there seems to be room for women to speak. We don't have to go quite as far, I don't think, as the Plymouth Brethren. And incidentally, I was Plymouth Brethren for many years as a missionary. That was my connection.
How do you, no, the second part of the question, how do you encourage?
Okay, how should we encourage, especially the single women? And I appreciate that, because I feel as though I have a very tough job trying to encourage the married women to stay home and to do something, to do this glorious job of being mothers to their children. My daughter, who has six and is a pastor's wife, does not do anything else in the church or outside the church. She did for a few years up until she was pregnant with number five, and at that point she said, I will be staying home from now on. And she gets criticized by many of the women in the church because she will not teach a Bible class and she doesn't go to all the meetings in the church. But I try to encourage her and all the other women that I know that they have no higher responsibility than to rear those children for God. But the single women, it's something else. And there is no doubt that in many churches, women's gifts have been overlooked, and there hasn't been scope for the exercise of women's gifts. And so I would certainly encourage men to get down to business and study what Paul did. And he was anything but a male chauvinist pig. When you read Paul's epistles, he was very gracious in his recognition of and thanks to women who had worked with him and for him. But at the same time, because there are so many voices on the other side, I'm always trying to encourage women to be willing to do, men and women, to be willing to do the hidden, small, little thing for which they will never get their name on a brass plate. I just talked with a woman a couple of weeks ago who had been a missionary. She had all sorts of experience and gifts and degrees and what else, what not. And her husband had been killed, and she came back to this country, to our country, and she said to me, she said, and they don't know what to do with me in the church. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, they just don't know what to do with me. And I said, well, why should they? What would you expect them to do with you? Well, she said, I don't know, but it just seems to be that they ought to recognize all this experience that I've got behind me and all these things that I could contribute. She said, I went to the pastor and I asked him what jobs needed to be done. And she said, do you know what he said? He told me to bake the communion bread. Now, she said, I have a master's degree. And I said, you go back there and you tell that pastor that you will be delighted to bake the communion bread. Eric Alexander and I were talking about this at lunchtime. is she qualified to do any other job unless she's willing to bake the communion bread? In John 13, it says that Jesus, to show the full extent of his love, washed feet. Now, wouldn't you think that going to the cross would be sufficient to show the full extent of his love? But he had to show these disciples, who were not necessarily going to be crucified, that there was a cross for them, and that they had to be willing to do the lowest, dirtiest, humblest, most invisible job, the job nobody else wants to do. And I want to tell you one little story. Can I? No.
Yeah.
Got three. A great lesson, another one of my spiritual mothers, a single lady who was my house mother in college. She had been brought up as a Southern belle, as they say in the Southern states. She did not know how to do anything but be charming and beautiful. She came from a very wealthy family, and when she became a Christian, she was disowned by that family and cut out of the inheritance that she would have gotten. She had to go to work. She had no idea what to do. She said she found out when she was a Christian that the only thing she could do was teach bridge, and American Christians were not very big on playing bridge. She ended up as a house mother in the dormitory where I was, and to my great blessing, she became a close friend of mine. She was not only my house mother, but she was also my Sunday school teacher. There was about 40 years difference between us. But she became a spiritual mother to me. And I used to go into her room and pour out my soul and my troubles, and she would occasionally tell me hers. And she said to me one day, she had this wonderful Georgia accent that doesn't mean a thing to you, but she called me Betty. And she said, "I came to Wheaton to be a spiritual counselor. But here I am carrying mops and toilet paper across the campus." Now, she was laughing about this. She wasn't angry. But I never forgot that. Now, she was a spiritual counselor to thousands of girls, hundreds of girls anyway. But the fact that she was willing to carry mops and toilet paper across the campus made what she said to me infinitely more important. And years later, I went to visit her when she was in an old folks' home, and I told her what she had said to me that day. I reminded her. And she blushed to the roots of her white hair, and she said, "Oh, Betty, did I say that?" And I said, "That's exactly what you said." And I told her what it had meant to me, how I would never forget it. And I said, "Because you were willing to do that." And she said, "Oh, to think of the mercy of God, that he allowed me to carry mops and toilet paper for his glory."
We can't express in words what you have given us. We are profoundly grateful, and I think all of us may be quite a bit different from now on in what you've many of the wonderful things you've said. Thank you dearly. We're very, very grateful. Jim, are you around? Is that organ still playable? I think we should, thanking the Lord for this dear woman and her man, not forgetting Lars, I think we should sing the doxology and the benediction together. Okay.
Sing the benediction.
We'll sing the doxology. We'll say the benediction. Don't be daft. I thought I'd taught you something by now. Come on, Stan.